Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. This is Cindy Sheehan, and you're listening at CindySheehanSoapbox.com or CommunityProgressiveRadio.org. Today's guest is Jonathan Simon. Jonathan is the author of Code Red, Computerized Election Theft and the New American Century, and he is co-founder and currently executive director of Election Defense Alliance. Jonathan Simon, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Thank you, Cindy. Great to be here.
Well, the reason I'm having you on and I asked you to be a guest is because both you and I were panelists at a recent event called the Democracy Conference in Madison, Wisconsin, and we were both on the election protection track or whatever you want to call it. And you, besides myself, you were the only one that I heard say the word revolution. And so I am all for exposing the crimes of the 1%, as Occupy calls it. I'm all for talking about a solution to those crimes, but I really think it has to be a revolutionary solution, because we're asking the people who benefit from these crooked laws, and not just laws, but from breaking existing laws, we're asking them to reform themselves. And so I think that that is basically a dead end. So thank you for saying that word. And tell my listeners about your book, Code Red, Computerized Election Theft and the New American Century.
Well, Cindy, you know, I did say that word, but of course, you know, the R word for revolution, I mean, it stirs up a lot of anxiety in me. I mean, I don't think revolutions are the stuff of storybooks. Most often they're dirty and dangerous and traumatic. So I have great ambivalences myself about, you know, as far as my crystal ball goes, about where we're heading, and, you know, how disruptive a transition to a better way of running a country and running a world would be.
Can I just say one thing, though? In Venezuela, Hugo Chavez inspired the Bolivarian Revolution that was almost 100% nonviolent. And the only violence came from the counter-revolution when they tried to overthrow him because of his Bolivarian Revolution that put a lot of these reforms into the new constitution. So revolution does not have to be violent. It doesn't have to be bloody. It just has to be have the support of a majority of the people.
I agree, and it does. It pains me that in the United States we're not seeing something along the lines, at least, of general strikes, tax revolt, even election boycotts, massive. It's hard to picture that in this country, and you know, that's a point that I've made frequently, is that we are an old democracy. Almost all of us were born into this democracy, if we were born here, and have a tendency to take it for granted and don't think of it as being fragile or needing a whole lot of upkeep other than just going down to the polls and voting or doing jury duty or whatever. And whereas there are other cultures where democracy is newer and harder won within living memory, where there is you know, a willingness to resort to people power, it is hard to vision that in this country. And you know, one reason is that we are culturally addicted to safety, security, speed, convenience, entertainment, bread and circus, and a pretty good job is done of keeping us busy, both in the sense of working busy, several jobs, who has time to worry about the public sphere and the larger issues of the day, even local issues, And keeping us busy when we're not working, watching sports events and watching, all sorts of entertainment extravaganzas. And, this is very seductive stuff. I certainly fall prey to it myself. And then, so if you're trying to generate the kind of energy that really can move the needle and bring about radical change, which I think we both agree is very much needed at this point, it's hard to see where that comes from in this country, except for the fact that we know that critical mass sometimes seems to come out of nowhere, and the pressures build up. They're largely below the surface. And an event that can be quite arbitrary. I mean, obviously, the Boston Massacre was one example in the revolutionary times. Something of relatively minor nature, then begins to take on a life of its own. Obviously, the Egypt and Libya and places like that, we've seen relatively small events. We saw a bit of that with Occupy. And we also saw what happened to Occupy and how quickly those who wanted to maintain systemic control made sure they snuffed it out. The question is, when does it go to the next level? When does it stop, being sort of comfortably sitting around or even uncomfortably sitting around in the public square to taking that next step when you are dispersed, to either not disperse or to find something else which speaks to power and speaks truth to power. And we haven't seen that yet. One suspects that, if we don't see that at some point, we're going to be in for a very, very, very negative and destructive sort of cultural experience and riot, because for whatever reason, and one can speculate on this, to one's heart's content, those in the position of power and control, or those who gravitate to those positions, really do seem to have an agenda. And in that agenda, the public, we the people, have essentially come to be the enemy. And we can see that with Bradley Manning. We can see that with Edward Snowden. We can see that with Occupy. There is this perceived danger where the people are really not to be trusted, and we are really there to be used and to feed the corporate system and to feed the consumer market system and to feed capitalism. And we, they're pretty good chess players, and they can picture probably better even than we can what, will happen when we are pushed too far, and they will then prepare, and they have prepared, as they did with Occupy, to handle that. And then the question becomes, where's our strategy, and how much of it can take place through the electoral system, how much of it can take place at the ballot box, will there even be a possibility for that? And, one of the theses of Code Red is that as long as elections are counted, votes are counted secretly on privatized, corporatized computers, there will not be any opportunity at the ballot box to change this direction. And the sense that there's something wrong with this picture can permeate quite widely through the public, and they will be impotent to change the picture through the democratic or political process. And to me, that's a very scary, eventuality to face, and we're pretty much already there.
Well, Jonathan, let's just, look at a historic perspective of this, because, many people seem to think that, elections just became compromised in 2000 or something like that, And one thing I mentioned at this democracy conference, the panel that we were on, was that the U.S. has never been a democracy. We're a representative republic. The founders, I don't think they trusted us then. They didn't think that you know, their agenda would be forwarded if they gave the people direct democracy. So they said, why don't we, you know, elect the representatives, and they'll, and so that's why we believe that just voting is our only part in this. And then we just send these people to D.C. or to our state capitals or wherever, and there's, and then we're supposed to trust that they're going to represent us and not the money or not the agenda of the quote unquote one, you know, 1%. And the only place we really see any kind of direct democracy might be in New England, you know, Vermont at their town hall meetings and things like that. But even that is just like giving the people a voice, and to me it rarely translates into policy. So, I mean, let's look at the big picture. It seems to me like everything that we've seen over the centuries has just led up to voting machines.
You know, that's an interesting way of looking at it. I mean, you're probably more radical than I am in these in this way of thinking, and that is that, you know, I'll go with Winston Churchill, who, you know, famously said, democracy is the worst system of government except for all the others. And, of course, he was talking about representative democracy and barely representative democracy at that. And, you know, on a large scale where you're looking at, you know, anything beyond the local level, and you're looking at states and you're looking at the national scene, I'd be willing to buy into representative democracy if votes were counted accurately and honestly and observably, so that the public had a basis for accepting the results of elections. Of course, you're going to have influences on elections. You're going to have financing issues. You're going to have lies that are told and political sleight of hand. You're going to have all of that. But my sense is that in the long run, you're going to get something that's better than most of the alternatives. Direct democracy really hasn't been tried. I mean, it might have been sampled with mixed results, it would seem to me, by something like Occupy. To me, it's a very awkward way of going about things. So I'm still, you know, an adherent of the idea of, okay, you go down to vote, but you add to that particular duty, and of course, in our country, it's optional to go to vote, but you add to that responsibility to your great, to the greater good and to the country, the role of being a participant in the particular part of the democratic process that has to do with tallying the votes, recording and tallying the votes. And to me, that's a very small modification of the kind of democracy we have now. And I agree, it's not a democracy, it's a representative republic. There were all sorts of restrictions built in, obviously racial, gender-based, property-based, qualifications were left to the states. It sure, you know, was a long way from some ideal, but then again, you know, Athenian democracy was the vote was maintained by what, you know, 5% of the population or less. So I don't think we've ever really seen an ideal on a large scale. And at this point, as much as I might want to experiment with an ideal, I would just like to get what we do. I have this basic faith that if we did nothing more than observe the votes being counted and deter or detect massive systemic vote counting fraud and theft, we'd be in a hell of a lot better shape than we are now. Wouldn't solve all the problems. You'd still have tremendous pressures on the part of the elites. You'd still have all sorts of issues of unfairness. But it would not be going quite so down the drain and down the rabbit hole as it's so quickly as it seems to be going now, where there is really little opportunity for electing people, let alone majorities, to public office who are willing to stand for the people on a consistent basis. And when the 99% realizes that it is the 99% and want to exercise that power through the ballot box, my sense is with the system that we have now, with the evidence we have about the frauds that are being committed on a regular basis, systemic theft and fraud, they're not going to be able to express that power. And then, I don't know, you either go to quiet desperation or you go to revolution. Neither one of those two strikes me as the best way to go. I mean, certainly not quiet desperation. And I would like to see representative democracy be given a fair chance. I'm not quite sure how we're going to accomplish that, given the powers that be that are already entrenched, but a push to either hand-counted paper ballots or very well-designed and scrupulously administered risk-limiting audits, something that can restore either direct observability or indirect observability to the vote count so that we have honest elections. We don't have this shift, this pervasive shift to the corporate side, to the right, in the vote counting, which we could discuss the evidence for that, but it's pretty well established. It's certainly presented in my book, Code Red. We don't have a chance as long as that prevails, and I'd like to see us have a chance.
Well, we certainly have seen a lot of evidence of voting on machines certainly compromises and changes the direction or legitimacy of elections. And the solutions you gave solutions to the problem. And how do we get there? How do we get to those solutions? What do you propose in your book to get to those solutions?
Well, I've had a recent tactical shift, and that is along these lines. In an ideal situation, if we were designing a polity from scratch, writing a constitution, I would be all for hand-counted paper ballots. I certainly believe we should vote on paper, vote recordably, create a record. The ballot is cast in such a way that the voter intent is not revealed, so you have what amounts to, it's called a secret ballot. It's really not a secret ballot, but the voter intent is not revealed. And it is counted in public. And, you know, at that same democracy conference, I was privileged to participate in a mock-up session, basically a workshop for counting paper ballots, and it was the first time I had ever done so, which was actually kind of, strange, because I've been in this field and been paying attention to electoral processes for well over a decade. And I had never actually sat down and mocked up a paper ballot hand count. And it was, I have to say, it was fun. It was mildly challenging. It brought people together. It gave one an empowered sense of being part of this process rather than just a passive spectator. And so it was all good. I think it would be invigorating rather than a chore for this country. And it would turn Election Day for a rotating small part of the population into a very, very public participation event. And so I'm very excited by that, and I'd like to see that. It brought tears to my eyes, actually. However, we're not starting with a tabula rasa. We have very strongly entrenched powers, fait accompli, that have come to be and have come to seem, to the powers that be in any way, the only logical way to be, whatever their motives are. And I suspect that among election administrators, the principal motive is to, is to enhance voter confidence and say, you can vote and not worry about a thing. So I don't think it's necessarily nefarious, but I do think that they have a certain see no evil, hear no evil kind of attitude towards this. In any case, trying to push through hand-counted paper ballots has been a very, very difficult, very uphill struggle in this country. And there are a few pockets around the country where ballots are counted by hand by people, most of them rural, most of them small areas. This could be expanded. There's no reason why it couldn't be done across the country in all areas. Remember, I mean, the number of counters is proportional to the number of people. So, you know, it's not like cities don't have the population to count the votes. But the institutional and political impediments are very high. So I have felt that if a sound, and that really is an important qualification, if a sound and effective audit protocol could be put in place, this is something that, especially what we call risk-limiting audits, which basically increase the amount of auditing, the proportion of auditing, as the preliminary results of the election get closer. So the smaller the margin, the more the auditing. And I can explain why, what the logic is behind that. But that type of audit, in the vast majority of elections, is very not burdensome from the election administrator standpoint. They don't have to audit a whole huge sample of ballots. And so that just may be, from the reactions we've had, a sell to the powers that be, to those who are entrenched. When you try to bring up an audit bill to a legislature, as we have here in Massachusetts where I live, and the county clerks are dead set against it, you're really, really bicycling into a very, very, very heavy wind. So that sale has to be made to the election administrators. And to give them something that they can do that is not daunting and overwhelming and represents really a relatively minor change in protocol is something that might work as far as being acceptable to them, and would also work very well as a deterrent to the kind of systemic, wholesale, computerized theft that we have detected in virtually all of the preceding elections since the computers went in, since they were deployed and proliferated. You don't need to deter election theft. You don't have to detect every election theft. You just have to create the impression, even the illusion, that those manipulations, those attempted rigs will be exposed. And what we've discovered, and particularly through the events of the 2012 election, I think has been underlined, is that election riggers, the Machiavellis of the election rigging game, are profoundly rational actors. There is a risk-reward calculation. And as the risk goes up, and that's what we believe that risk-limiting audits would do, the willingness to go through and risk widespread exposure, which would put an end to the rigging enterprise, the willingness to take that risk goes way down. And you can actually wind up with a relatively clean election. Yes, there might be a vote stolen here or a vote stolen there, or somebody voting twice here or there. You don't steal a country by hand by having a couple of dead people vote. You steal it through a machine. I mean, it goes back to, you know, Chuck Herron, the IT professional, once brilliantly put it, and very simply, and it's something that everybody should think about and keep in mind. He said, it takes a long time to steal 10,000 votes by hand. It takes 3 seconds to do it on a computer. And I think he was overestimating the 3 seconds. Yeah. It takes one key punch. Yeah. And that's 10,000 votes here and 100,000 votes there. If there are no mechanisms in place, as there are not, to in the vast majority of places, either no mechanisms or grossly inadequate mechanisms place to check what's happening with the computers, really the sky and just good taste is the limit to what you can steal. And it just takes, I'll just throw out a very basic exploit. You can set the zero counters on the memory cards that go into the optical scan machines that many of us vote on, that actually have a paper ballot, which is never looked at, not open to public inspection, so you might as well not have it in the way the current system is set up. You can set the zero counters, which is where the counting of the votes for that night in that particular race begins, to plus 50 for candidate A, who you want to win, and minus 50 for candidate B, who you want to lose. At the end of the night, the election administrator looks at it, sees the right number of votes, matches the poll tapes, all's good, certifies the election. You've just shifted 100 votes per machine. You could shift 200 votes per machine. You could shift 500 votes per machine by using this. It takes 5 lines of code. On each of those memory cards, there's somewhere between 500,000 and 700,000 lines of code. Put in 5 more lines, change the memory card zero counters, and you just stolen all those votes. Undetectable. I mean, you can put in self-deleting code, but even if you don't put in self-deleting code, those memory cards are not open to public inspection. We cannot get a memory card to analyze it. We certainly can't get a memory card as it was actually used on Election Day. And when I say we, this includes election officials. It includes state senators. It includes congresspeople. Nobody. That's corporate property, completely proprietary. It's more protected than Fort Knox or our nuclear installations. You can't get it. So it's that easy. PDQ. And what we've seen is that the elections that are most vulnerable are generally not, with the exception of 2004, presidential elections. They're U.S. House elections, state House elections, state legislative elections, where there are no exit polls. There's very little scrutiny. These elections are completely, absolutely, completely just lying out there in the sun, waiting to be rigged. And what we saw in the 2010 election, the numerical patterns, the outcome patterns, was so bizarre, so unusual, it was absolutely pathognomonic of systemic rigging. And, you know, we've learned not to bring this up in polite company, not to bring up actual fraud, because it scares people, and then they don't want to go anywhere near it. So we've learned to just kind of finesse things and be polite, and talk about the vulnerability of the machines. And in fact, that's enough. That's all you have to talk about, because these machines are so vulnerable. We use the man behind the curtain image.
Uh-huh.
And you just ask people, you know, would you hand your ballot to a man in a magician suit who then goes behind a curtain, counts, quote unquote, the ballots, shreds the ballots, comes out and tells you who won? I mean, would you trust that election? And would you trust that election if the guy was wearing an Obama for president or a Palin for president button or some sort of partisan signifier? Even less. This is what we're doing when we're voting on touch screens, when we're voting on optical scan equipment. It is no different from handing our ballot to a man who goes behind the curtain, comes out and tells us who won. And those elections really, they look good on TV. And you see all the blinking pie charts, you see all the bar graphs, you see the pundits talking about this effect and that effect and the economy for 18 to 34-year-olds. It all looks good. All the window dressing is beautiful. And underneath it all, you have a recording and counting process that is no different from just a magician who goes behind the curtain. And absolutely, absolutely cannot be trusted, absolutely vulnerable to all sorts of manipulation. And one of the reasons we believe we're in the pickle we are now in this country, mm-hmm. where people are looking at it and saying, what the hell is wrong, is because these preceding elections, certainly since the computers went in, there was fraud, there was skullduggery before that, but it was retail, small scale. Since the computers went in, we've seen a wave of shift to the right, to the corporate side. So you have public opinion way to the left. And yes, there is a partisan dimension here. It is not to say that the left cannot get on their horse and start counter-rigging. We may have seen that in 2012. Is this the kind of election system we want, where you have the riggers and the counter-riggers? It's like living in, you know, Shinbone and in The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance and some godforsaken, you know, frontier town. And you got the white hats and the black hats shooting it out in front of the OK Corral, and you're just a citizen. You're just stuck there waiting to see who wins. I mean, that is not democracy. That's not what we want.
Well, Jonathan, I think that might be a good place to tell people your website, and can they get information or order your book from your website?
Cindy, I've written Code Red with a lot of this passion, but also a lot of factual material and pretty direct answers. A lot of it is in a question and answer format, and presents things very directly. And the best place to get Code Red is currently, we're looking at print book publication there, through various means, but currently it's available as an e-book on Amazon, and it is best accessed through a Tiny Earl that I created. So it's www.tinyearl.com/capitals, all caps, CODERED, Code Red, 2013. And I'm executive director of Election Defense Alliance. The website for there is electiondefensealliance.org. And I'm a participant in the National Election Integrity Coalition. And that's also has a website, electionintegrityorganization.org. You know, the plug that I would put in for Code Red is this. There have been quite a few books that have been written about election theft and election fraud and election dynamics and vote counting and whatnot. Many of them are rather technical and dry, not particularly easy to get through and not tremendously inspiring. There are a few that are shrill to the point where you wonder whether there's any evidence to back up some of the claims. I tried to take a road in between that with Code Red and present a lot of evidence, not be particularly shrill, and present it in a way that is encouraging and alarming at the same time. And, you know, so you'd come away from it knowing a lot more about this area and being willing, and this is really the key point, being willing to talk to other people about this basic aspect of democracy and spread a word and not be afraid to ruin people's days, because ultimately you're going to be saving people's days. And, you know, it's the kind of topic that people, I think, are a little shy, well, more than a little shy, very shy about, very afraid of talking about. My God, America is the beacon of democracy. How could we be undercutting this faith in America? Well, it is not the beacon of democracy right now. It needs to be undercut. This needs to be understood. The word needs to spread. Opinion leaders need to get a hold of this and begin to spread that word through whatever megaphones and processes they have. And so that's where I hope the book will come in handy. And again, it's www.tinyearl.com/CodeRed2013. Or you can just go to Amazon and type in Code Red as a search, and you come down to Jonathan Simon's Code Red. There are a few others out there. And read it and comment and review and spread the word. This is critical. And if we're ever going to get to critical mass, people have to be willing to participate and get involved and begin to put strong pressure on the system through a variety of means to make this basic change so that we can have our elections back and we can have a representative democracy that, if it's going to work, you know, if representative democracy works at all, will reflect the public will. And
well, thank you,
I think
Jonathan.
That's what the best we can do.
Thank you so much for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. And all the links will be at my website and the newsletter also, so people can check it out. So, Jonathan Simon, thank you for your time. Thank you for your work. And thank you for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
Cindy, thank you very much. Keep trucking.
Well, that was the show for today. I hope you learned something. In my defense, I thought Code Red was actually about revolution because there's some connotations there, aren't there? But I do believe that it was a very informative interview, and Jonathan certainly is passionate about reform. As always, I'd like to thank my engineer, Don DeBar, and I'd like to thank my guest, Jonathan Simon. I'd like to thank you for listening and supporting the show. This is Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Peace out for now.